Welcome to episode 74. I'm Stuart McCullough. I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with respect to community health, as it continues to work its way through bargaining. There are now proposals out for consideration by community health members. Those proposals include medical scientists covering dietitians and audiologists and pharmacists, as well as allied health professionals. With respect to allied health professionals, there is a proposal that is agreed between VHAA and VAPA, which has been recommended to our respective members. There is a meeting with community health members on Tuesday of this week to discuss that proposal ahead of the request for endorsement. With respect to our health service members, there's drafting with respect to dental therapists this week. There's also the Metro HR and IR managers meeting this week. That will then be followed by the overarching reference group. A key focus for the overarching reference group will be to begin to work through the list of review items. There's also meetings with respect to the NUM classification framework, and then further drafting for the dentists and dental specialists this week. As always, all of our activities are summarised through the VHA Community app. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. This place is full of spies. I think they're on to me. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. Joining me for this week's discussion is the Manager of Workplace Relations Services and fresh from his semi-final appearance in Australian Ninja Warrior, Tim Nagle. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Stuart. Good to be here.
I'm sure it is. Tim, would you be good enough to reveal the clue for today's discussion?
Sure.
So for the benefit of those who are listening to this podcast, rather than watching, would you be good enough to describe the object? We might just hold these up as well.
They're safety earmuffs.
Safety earmuffs. And which suggests what subject?
Public holidays matrix.
Tim, I understand what you're getting at there, but you're also very, very wrong. Perhaps I'm being a little unfair, and the best way to make my point is to get you to put these on. So, Tim, I'm not sure what that experience was like, but I guess I'd ask the question, did that make our conversation easier or more difficult?
More difficult.
Which brings us, of course, to today's subject for discussion, difficult conversations. We're going to be talking about how to prepare, how to conduct, how to respond during the course of difficult discussions.
And what are examples of difficult discussions?
There are some discussions that are inherently difficult. Those would include dispute meetings, disciplinary meetings, either as part of an investigation process or a disciplinary outcome process, and organisational change meetings. Sometimes meetings can be difficult simply because of the people who are involved in those meetings.
And so what should you do before a difficult meeting?
The first thing that you should do is do as much of the work that you can through the correspondence before the meeting occurs. That includes just ensuring that all the steps that can be taken through correspondence have been taken in advance.
Why is that?
That's because there is nothing that can get a meeting off track as quickly as surprise.
That was surprising.
Indeed. Nothing gets a meeting off track quicker than surprise.
What's an example of the kind of things that might be addressed in correspondence before a meeting?
If it's a meeting that's a part of a process, and I'm thinking about a disciplinary process, an organisational change process, a dispute process, describe that process in the letter. That is, you're telling the employee and the representative what it is that's going to happen in advance. And in doing so, it's a good idea to connect that process to the relevant underpinning document. For example, if the process is arising out of a policy of the organisation, connect it to that policy. If it arises from an enterprise agreement, then connect it to the enterprise agreement. What you're doing is that you're showing that you know what the rules are and that you're committing yourself to follow those rules, but you're also telling the other party what they can expect and telling them that those are the rules that they also need to comply with.
So all designed to reduce the surprises in the meeting?
That's correct.
Are there any other procedural issues to deal with?
Yeah, look, I think so. It's worth addressing any rights that an employee may have in the letter. And that is, if an employee has a right of representation, then you should say so in the letter before the meeting occurs. What you're seeking to avoid when you're doing that is a circumstance where someone has a right of representation and attends a meeting without being aware that they have that right. In almost all circumstances, it's difficult to know or difficult to see how a meeting could actually proceed under those circumstances if someone has a right, they haven't exercised that right because they didn't know they had it. So make sure that you deal with those things in the correspondence so that people are aware of what they can and can't do and so that you don't have to make a decision to defer the meeting because somebody didn't exercise a right they didn't know they had.
So you've advised them about the process. Is there anything else?
Yeah, detail the purpose. I think you should detail the purpose in simple, plain, straightforward way in the correspondence. There should be no doubt for an employee as to what the purpose of a meeting is. Examples may include whether or not the purpose of the meeting is to respond, whether it's to identify mitigating issues, whether it is to suggest avenues for investigation, or in the case, say, of organisational change, whether the purpose of the meeting is to propose alternatives or measures that may mitigate or avert the impact of the proposed change.
And why is that so important?
Think about it from the employee's perspective. So things like organisational change, disciplinary procedures, dispute settlement, those are things that people and culture departments deal with all the time. But from the perspective of an employee, these will be fairly novel and perhaps intimidating processes with which they're not particularly familiar with. So I think it's really important to just explain why it is that the meeting is occurring.
And why the emphasis on putting things in writing?
Quite simply, even if there isn't a prescription or a requirement to set those things out in writing under an enterprise agreement, it helps you and it helps your organisation if you can show that those things have been done. What you don't want to be is in a circumstance where you assert that those sort of procedural requirements have been ticked off and someone else to disagree. If you put it in writing, you can show it. It means it's beyond contest.
We've all been in situations where there's two different versions of what happened in a meeting or purpose of a meeting. So what else should happen before a difficult meeting occurs?
I think the simplest piece of advice to give to anyone is prepare. There are some meetings that we all have to attend where you simply need to turn up and the meeting runs its course. They're predictable, they're reliable, you know how the meeting is going to run in a broad sense. But difficult meetings are in a different category. Difficult meetings need preparation.
And what kind of preparation?
So an example of that would be if the matter has a history to it, a range of correspondences, for example. Be familiar with that history. If it's a big history, you might want to prepare something like a chronology. Sometimes knowing the order in which things have happened is extremely useful for the purpose of a meeting. Review all correspondences. And when you're reviewing all those correspondences, satisfy yourself that those previous correspondences were fair, appropriate, and above all, compliant. If you do identify a problem with earlier correspondences, that's okay. It's far better to identify those things in advance than it is to have them presented to you for the first time during the course of the meeting. What you're seeking to do by becoming familiar with the matter is to ensure that you get a sense of the kind of things that may come up during the course of a meeting. That doesn't eliminate the potential for surprise, but it does reduce it. And it means that you can give some thought to the kind of questions that may come up and what your response might be before the meeting occurs.
So what about the meeting itself?
Well, in terms of the meeting itself and before that meeting starts, think about the meeting. And that is, think about who should be there. think about the dynamics between the parties. Think about how it's going to be run, what questions might arise and how you might respond. Some questions are entirely predictable. For example, an employee will almost inevitably want to know, how long before I get a response? What's going to happen next? By thinking about how the meeting might run, you can prepare in your own mind responses to those kinds of queries. Give some thought as to what you need to get out of a meeting. What is it you need to obtain from a meeting in order to meet your requirements? Think about whether or not you need one room or two rooms. There are some kinds of meetings where it's appropriate for the parties to break apart for a period of time and to conduct separate deliberations. An example of that might be in the context of a dispute. What you want to avoid is the circumstance where one party is in a room and the other party is standing outside, standing in a hallway where everyone can see, or conferring in a space that is not a private space. Have a think about what it is you need from an infrastructure point of view to make that a successful meeting. None of this prevents a surprise, but it does reduce that risk just a little bit more.
So they're really about that preparation period, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. And about the how about the meeting itself?
The first thing to remember is that if you're responsible for running a meeting, then run the meeting. Don't let it run itself. Don't expect it to run itself or for someone else to run it for you. That means introducing people. It means engaging with them, telling them where the amenities are, offering them water. If you're hosting the meeting, host the meeting. Freon?
And not for me, thank you.
You may change your mind later. Those first few moments of a meeting are really crucial in terms of setting the tone, and it can really impact how a discussion proceeds. Sometimes that means trying to put people at ease. It's worth remembering that if it's going to be a difficult meeting for you as a practitioner, it will be even more difficult for the employee who's impacted.
And why would you want to put people at ease for that process?
So it has to be said, that's not going to be possible for every kind of meeting. For a disciplinary meeting, there's not much you can do to make it easier, but you really just need to ensure that those meetings are respectful. But some difficult meetings may involve the parties seeking to reach an agreement or a resolution. And part of the job of conducting a difficult meeting is to create an environment where an agreement or a resolution is possible. That's why courtesy and making people feel, if not comfortable, then a little less uncomfortable, is really important.
And what would be next?
Briefly state the purpose of the meeting and refer to any relevant details. So, for example, you might refer to the details of an allegation contained in a correspondence of a particular date and advise that the purpose of the meeting is to provide an opportunity to respond as part of an investigation, or you might identify the date of the grievance.
And what's the point of doing that?
What you're doing when you're doing that is taking the meeting to a certain point and ensuring that everybody understands the reason that they're there, notwithstanding that you've done that in correspondence, but you're really taking it up to the point where it's then appropriate for an employee or the representative to provide a response.
Just on the representative, what's the role of the representative? Should I allow them to speak for the employee, for example?
So this is a real conundrum for members as to whether or not somebody should be there as a support person in a strong but silent capacity or whether they're there as a representative. It may well be that there are some industrial requirements that only refer to a support person, but our advice would be that people should not get stuck on what the role of the representative is. If it is that somebody attends and wants to speak, and you believe that they should only be there to give strong but silent support, what that does, then it then makes the issue of what is the role of the representative, that becomes the issue for the meeting. That is, you get stuck talking about procedure when, in fact, you're there to meet for some substantive reason. And in those circumstances, you run a risk that the meeting may never progress beyond the procedural stage and get into the substantive issues that you are actually there to talk about. We talked earlier about the fact of having your purpose in mind. And by having your purpose in mind, it's worth being flexible on process so that your substantive purpose doesn't become a casualty of the discussion.
So really it's about whether they can use or not use the opportunity as they wish?
I think they should be able to use the opportunity any way they wish to. That is, for disciplinary proceedings, organisational change, dispute, there is an entitlement there that the person has and is exercising, which is to respond or put their side of the story across. And in doing so, they should be able to do so however they see fit.
So how about a representative, for instance, who asks a lot of questions or raises irrelevant matters?
So when I was a kid, if you were in dispute with someone and you wanted to shut that down, you might say, look over there. And when the person turned their back, you might run away. I think sometimes raising irrelevant matters is another form of look over there. It's a form of distraction. And I think the challenge for members is to not allow that to become a disruption to the meeting itself. And but it is a common technique that people can use to seek to derail the process. I think what's crucial for members is that they are able to spot that when it occurs, to separate legitimate inquiry from things that are less legitimate or are intended to disrupt or derail the process.
What's the example of that?
A representative might assert non-compliance with a policy or an industrial instrument. They might assert a lack of detail. They may refer to a completely non-related set of circumstances or an earlier instance involving other employees.
And what should our members' response be to that?
It's worth, at that point, I think, referring to the fact that this meeting has been planned and that everything has been set out in writing. This is where you're setting up the process and procedure in writing and connecting it to the policy, connecting it to the enterprise agreement becomes particularly important, I think. So under those circumstances, you'd be saying that it would have been people have had an opportunity to consider their position before today, and if there were any concerns, it would have been appropriate to raise those concerns ahead of the meeting.
And what if they insist?
Again, what you're doing then, I think, is then returning to the purpose of the meeting. The purpose of a difficult meeting is usually to provide an opportunity to respond. And for me, what I would do at that point is note the fact that that those matters may interfere with the opportunity that the employee is entitled to have their say, to respond, to participate, to tell their version of events.
So you've referred to entitlements in the employee. Why is that?
Most of the difficult meetings that have to be conducted are the result of an entitlement. People aren't necessarily choosing to meet. They're required to meet in order to fulfil a requirement of an enterprise agreement or a policy, as it were. And it's unusual for people to have to meet as a result of obligations. So the reason for bringing it back to the employee is reminding everybody that if the meeting does go off the rails, it is the employee who loses their entitlement or has their entitlement to an opportunity to respond impacted.
What if a representative, for instance, raises something that's just completely irrelevant?
I think one of the challenges for members is where an unrelated matter, a red herring, arises. For me, I would bring it back to the purpose of the meeting and then identify a more appropriate way to raise that issue. It may well be that an unrelated matter is something that could be fairly raised as part of a grievance process, but that raising it now will distract from or detract from an employee's entitlement to respond or consider. But in doing that, by proposing another way to deal with those issues, what you're not doing is dismissing the substance of those issues. It may not be the right time to raise those issues, but if mitigating circumstances are raised at any time or some other, you want to be mindful that somebody might raise the right thing at the wrong time as opposed to the wrong thing at the wrong time. So if mitigating circumstances come up when you're seeking a response to the facts, you wouldn't dismiss those, but you would make note of them before moving on to the bit you need to get to. If it's something wholly unrelated, you're directing it into another process, such as a grievance procedure.
And what if the meeting become heated, for instance?
It happens from time to time. If someone's getting heated, there are a number of things you can do. The first thing is, do not respond in kind. Even if someone's getting animated, don't escalate along with them. Escalation is the most effective way to disrupt a meeting. Moreover, if a meeting does escalate, and in terms of the consequences of that escalation, first of all, a representative will use that escalation as evidence of unfairness to the employee. And if there is some examination by a third party with regards to that escalation, it is almost certain that there will be more focus on the employer's response than there will be on the representative's role in contributing to that escalation. Even if it's reciprocal, you should not want to escalate. If it's somebody on your side of the table, that is a manager for your health service or someone that you are working with who is becoming a bit animated and is escalating, take a break. Take a break immediately. If it's a representative for the employee, the other thing that you can do if things are escalating is slow things down. Speak softly, take your time. Effectively, you're trying to prevent a sense of momentum from building. If people are distressed, or if you think it could be become unsafe, of course, bring the meeting to an end. But those are techniques that you can do to prevent that momentum from getting away.
And you mentioned breaks. What role does breaks play?
Breaks can be a really useful technique for both parties to consider things that the other party has said. It can also disrupt the momentum of a meeting, which is particularly useful if it's difficult. It also gives you a chance to alter the dynamic between the parties.
And what do you mean by that, the altering of the dynamic?
When you have a group of people in a room, then the nature of that conversation is affected by all those participants. If you change that dynamic and people are engaging separately and without all those other people present, it could mean that the opportunities for dialogue are enhanced.
And even if they were being disruptive, do you think that applies?
Yeah, look, that's a funny thing. So sometimes a representative will feel the need to be disruptive in the meeting that you're in. It may well be, for example, that what they're seeking to do is demonstrate to their client, demonstrate to their member, that they're doing all they can to fight for their interests. But it may be that once you get out of that environment, that they're prepared to have a different kind of discussion with you. They may be prepared to speak to you on a without prejudice basis or to be more candid. But changing the dynamic can yield different results.
What should members keep in mind in relation to that?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges for members is to, if you do get a difficult representative, if the representative is the source of what of the difficulties in the meeting, is to not allow that to affect your judgment in terms of any decision you may need to make with regards to the employee.
You mean don't hold the bad representative against the employee?
Exactly.
What else would you suggest?
The other thing I think people should be mindful of is don't think that you need to be able to answer every question right away. If you don't know the answer, take the question on notice. It is far better for you to take a question away from you, from a meeting, than it is to give an inadequate answer. An inadequate answer will then probably result in a challenge to that answer, and then in turn that becomes the subject of the meeting. If you don't know the answer, don't guess. Take the question away from you and provide a response within an agreed time frame. That should prevent the meeting veering off to some kind of tangent.
Anything else?
We talked earlier about being prepared. I just want to reiterate with regards to that last point. Being prepared does not mean that you need to know the answer for everything. In terms of anything else, when you close the meeting, tell people what's going to happen next and stick to that. If you need to conduct further investigations, then take the time that you need. But once the meeting is over, do review your notes and think about anything else that you can do to follow up on matters arising from that meeting.
Such as?
If you didn't get a chance to talk to the representative during the course of the meeting, give them a call afterwards. Again, it's about that change in dynamic. They may or may not want to talk, but it could be that they're far more candid outside the meeting. What you're doing is really testing the opportunity for discussion. And it may be successful, it may be unsuccessful.
Is there anything else to finish us off about difficult meetings?
Look, obviously, and just for the sake of completeness, it needs to be said that members who are conducting difficult meetings should not do so alone. I think that's just a common sense thing. But the last thing I would say is avoid small talk. Even if you know the representative particularly well, bear in mind the fact that the employee who's being represented is probably having a pretty difficult day. and under those circumstances keep things courteous and respectful, but don't talk about your weekend in front of someone who might be about to lose their job. So I think that just goes to that issue of respect.
Well, thank you, Stuart, for taking us through difficult meetings today.
I think the only way really for us to conclude is I'll present these to you on a permanent basis. You may want to put those back on. And I think you should have the free on.